Jim Rubens, welcome to All Things Considered.
Good evening.
We'll start with the economy. You've said your number one priority is to bring good-paying jobs back to American soil. And there was a recent report that suggested the jobs being created in the recovery aren't paying as well as those lost during the recession. What's driving that, do you think, and what should be done about it?
Well, we've got to make product and services in America again. We've got to shift our policy away from being a progressively consumer-based economy to a production economy. And it's going to take a variety of things to do that. We've got to change our tax code. We have a tax code which is forcing companies offshore, forcing manufacturing offshore. We've got to simplify and make lower the rates on corporate and personal taxes, simpler, fairer, flatter tax code. We've got to get corporate rates down as low as Europe. We've got to get down to the low 20s. We've got to take away the corporate cronyist exemptions in the tax code so we can pay for the rate reduction. We need to fix our regulatory structure. We are now the 17th most economically free country in the world. We've slipped from third in just 13 years. We're now more regulated in our economy than Great Britain, Canada, Norway. So we've got to dial back these incredibly complex regulations that inhibit small business. We're a small business economy in New Hampshire. Laws like Obamacare, like Dodd-Frank, like the Food Safety and Modernization Act that's hurting small business in our state. We've got to dial back these regulations. I'm proposing that every 10 years, all these regulations be sunset. They go back to Congress. Congress looks at them. Are they compliant with statute? Are they constitutional? Are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? So we can reduce the burden on small business. We need to reduce energy costs. My website, jimrubens.com, has a more detailed plan on that. But corporate cronyism in energy has locked us into antique energy technologies like 30-year-old, 40-year-old nuclear technologies. We're subsidizing this stuff. Let the free market give us abundant, inexpensive, clean energy, and let these entrepreneurs that we have, you know, we're endowed with this in America, let these benefits accrue to the entire free world so that we're not buying natural gas from Russia and oil from OPEC anymore. We need to reduce health care costs as another way to bring jobs back to America. We have the highest health care costs in the world, twice as high as our industrial nation competitors. Obamacare is driving up these costs. We need to bring these health care costs down through free market solutions like more different kinds of insurance, allow insurance to be sold across state line, deal with the $30 to $200 billion a year in Medicare and Medicaid fraud, let the federal government negotiate the cost of pharmaceuticals so that our people are not paying the highest prices in the world for pharmaceuticals. The list goes on. Stabilize our currency. We're spending $1 out of every $5 to fund the federal government now is printed money. We're putting our entire currency at risk. This suppresses onshore manufacturing. And finally, we need to close the borders. We need to have borders. We're the only industrial nation on earth that has an open border on our southern border. Close the border. We need immigration. It has to be legal. And at this point, reserve the jobs for American citizens and those who are legally entitled to be here. Jobs for Americans.
That's quite a list, and we'll tick back through a few of the points that you mentioned. Just to come back to regulation, the concern in the immediate aftermath of the Great Recession was there was a lack of regulation in some sectors of finance. Is there a way to strike a balance between what's going on now between Dodd-Frank and what you're saying is where businesses are being hampered?
We have to strike the right balance. Dodd-Frank is a great example of overregulation. Post the financial meltdown of 2007, 2008, 2009, we got Dodd-Frank, written by the Wall Street lobbyists, the too big to fail banks. We now know from a recent report by the FDIC and the Federal Reserve Board, we now know that the too big to fail banks who wrote the Dodd-Frank bill, and I'm afraid to say paid certain people in the U.S. Senate to vote for it, through their campaign contributions, millions of dollars, the too big to fail banks are bigger than they were before, bigger market share. The American taxpayer is still at risk for the next bailout. And it suppressed and injured small business lending in our state. Small business people cannot get loans. People attempting to buy houses cannot buy houses. It's suppressing the small business economy. So we need solutions to protect the world's financial system and the American financial system that don't inhibit small business. And it means that we have to have solutions probably more like after the Great Depression of 1928 through 1933, the Glass-Steagall Act solved that problem for decades. We took away the Glass-Steagall Act under President Clinton. In less than 10 years, we had the Great Financial Meltdown. So We decided to cozy up in Congress. They cozied up to the Wall Street banks. They passed Dodd-Frank, and now New Hampshire's paying the price.
So you would be potentially in favor of reinstituting something like the Glass-Steagall Act, which would separate out some of that investment banking from some of the other portions of finance?
The key thing is that the people who caused this financial meltdown, the stockholders, the bondholders, and the management of these 11 too-big-to-fail banks, and mark me, they're still too big. They're still too big to fail. They should have been held accountable for what they did. No one's been held accountable. They've been slapped on the wrist with some minor fines. There's been no evidence given to the public in trials and litigation and civil litigation as to who did what. They should have been held accountable. The stockholders, bondholders, and managers should have been held accountable. They should have paid the price for the problem, and they've been let off. Okay, so we have done crony capitalism big time. Probably the biggest example we've seen in decades. And so we've sent a message back to the crony capitalists, prey on the American consumer, the American economy, go down to Washington, give out big campaign contributions to people who will vote with the crony capitalists, and you can get your way. I'm against that. That's why I'm in favor of public financing of elections, so that people who want to represent the interests of small business in the state of New Hampshire can have the millions of dollars to campaign and to represent the people of New Hampshire as an alternative to this special interest financing system we have right now, which is so distorted politics in the country that we can't do the people's work.
To come back to high-paying jobs for a moment, you mentioned some of the ways that you would try to boost the economy as a production economy rather than a consumer-based economy.
Yeah.
Is there enough of an incentive then for employers to look at the U.S. workforce and say, we're going to go here at a time when we're in the global economy and you have skilled workers in other parts of the world who will say, I'll do similar or the same work for much less in the way of pay and benefits?
It's true that we want to preserve a pay advantage for Americans. That's critical. Now, we have advantages in the United States. We're the best country in the world. Even though we've got problems, we remain the best and freest country in the world in general. So we have a great system of laws. We have a strong civil society where we're tolerant of one another. You can drive down the road and move between town to town and state to state without being held, without being hijacked or being requested to give bribes. We have a robust entrepreneurial pool in our country. We have talent in this country, phenomenal. We have an incredible ability to raise capital for entrepreneurs to invent new products and services, and we're close to our own market. So we have these built-in advantages in the United States, and if we would take away the impediments caused by excessive government intrusion that is suppressing the activities of small business, small growing business where the jobs are, where the job growth is, we would find that the natural advantages we have in the United States would take hold again, and we would have these growing companies. We'd have entrepreneurs again saying, yes, I'm going to start a company here in New Hampshire. Yes, I'm going to start a company here in New Hampshire, and I'm going to hire people right now. The combination of things like Dodd-Frank and Obamacare is causing entrepreneurs the uncertainty, the massive surfeit of regulation is causing people to hold back. And we can unleash this entrepreneurial energy in America by dialing back these regulations, which is why I'm proposing sunsetting these regulations every 10 years to find out if they're working or not.
You've proposed an alternative to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
And one of the pieces of that is, and I'll just quote from your website, to accommodate diversity in insurance preferences. So, for example, the so-called young invincibles could opt for catastrophic coverage only, or someone dealing with infertility could have that added to their coverage. Someone who isn't could leave that out. Does that potentially run the risk, though, of having what we've seen in recent years where people who don't need coverage don't get it, and the people who do need it find the prices higher than they can or would like to pay?
I'm not in favor of mandating people to buy a product and service, and that includes health insurance, so that we need to restructure the health insurance marketplace so that people are incentivized to buy insurance. How do you do that? You let the free market, you let insurers and hospital and health providers, whether they be insurers or not, or networks of hospitals and care providers, provide products and services that people want to buy. That's why I'm proposing things like long-term health insurance, sort of like term life insurance, so that the young invincibles can buy, when they're young and invincible and don't have any bad health history, can buy 20 years or 30 years of health insurance at a known price, be incentivized to take care of themselves in their own interest. It's why I support allowing insurers to have a much broader portfolio of products and services available to consumers. Let insurers sell across state lines. Let there be a huge increase in the extent to which we allow medical savings accounts and health savings account to give consumers control over their first dollar expenditures and save money that they save by being responsible consumers of health care, so that money can go tax-free into their retirement accounts and perhaps be passed on to their heirs. So we can structure incentives into the solution so that people are not compelled to buy insurance, so that they want to buy insurance in their own interest. But the marketplace needs to be released from the clutches of Obamacare, which has the fingerprints of Jean Shaheen all over it, community rating, forcing young people to pay for insurance at twice the rates that they would ordinarily pay in the free market. And so then we have to discipline people with fines and penalties and sick the IRS on them. That's not the way we do things in the United States of America.
But for those who are already, say, have a pre-existing condition, are they then going to, is there enough of a shared risk amongst the entire population?
We have to deal with the pre-existing condition problem. We have to deal with people who are in a circumstance. So this is why we need to beef up catastrophic care pools. There's a role for government in shaping them and managing them so that they're available to everyone. Again, I'm not going to propose that we compel anyone to buy that, but people want it. Again, this is core conservative philosophy. We live in a country where we are endowed with the rights of liberty and to control our own lives. And we trust people to take care of themselves because people want to do that. They want to take care of themselves and their families. And so there is a role for government in helping make sure there are catastrophic pools for people with pre-existing conditions to solve that problem. It's a reason that I propose beefing up and expanding things called community health clinics that are providing primary care for people with insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, insurance, CHIP, no insurance, payment plans. It's shown here in New Hampshire, there are 10 of them operating now with a new one starting in my own area, that they can produce primary care, including dental care, checkups for the kids, at half the cost of the hospital and traditional insurance-based system. So there are ways we can solve problems that are bottom-up, that are diverse, that are reflective of the needs of communities as their needs may vary. It's part of core conservative Republican philosophy. Bottom-up solutions do not have life controlled by the federal government. One size fits all simply does not work, and it's taking our freedoms away. Obamacare is an egregious mistake, contrary to the principles of the founding of this country.
We're talking with Jim Rubens, a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate. And since you mentioned energy earlier, I wanted to ask about energy, because you have proposed, when it comes to energy, an end to all federal energy subsidies to let the market essentially sort it out, whether it's gas, whether it's oil, coal, solar, and so on. At the same time, does that put U.S. companies at a competitive disadvantage when, say, a solar firm in China may be getting low-interest loans, if not outright subsidies, and then coming to the U.S. to sell products?
I'm a free trade guy, but there are circumstances such as the one you just described where countervailing duties may be called for when you have industrial planning by a country like China, which is artificially beyond the capacity of China to produce solar PV cells cheaper than they would otherwise cost. There is a role for countervailing duties there that distorts the marketplace. On the other hand, I believe that the free market will produce us, as I say, inexpensive, abundant, clean energy faster than market manipulation by the federal government. When the federal government gets involved in doing things like forcing us to put ethanol into our gas tanks, artificially increasing the cost of corn, causing starvation in Africa, this is not accelerating the pace of development of affordable abundant clean energy. So again, coming back to the United States of America, we are endowed with entrepreneurial talent and capital resources. No other country has these resources. And if we unleash these people instead of going to Washington to get a new tax break every 2 years or some kind of crony capitalist market distortion, if we focus these entrepreneurs on going to the marketplace and giving people what they want, which is less expensive energy, we're going to get there faster. We need in America, there are some Republicans who crow about this wonderful $100 a barrel oil that we can import into New Hampshire from other states. I don't think that's the way we want. That's not the way the New Hampshire economy is going to succeed. America was at its peak of middle class prosperity when we had $20 a barrel oil back between 1947 and 1972. We want to get back to abundant, inexpensive energy again. Entrepreneurs will get us there through things like solar PV, which is dropping down the cost curve like semiconductors at an incredibly rapid rate. Solar PV without subsidies in new construction is cost effective in New Hampshire now and continues to rapidly move down the cost curve. So you let our entrepreneurs loose, they're going to invent us progressively more and more inexpensive batteries and solar PV and other forms of energy, pellets that we can produce here in the state. We can drill down and harvest energy from 54 degree granite in our state right here, right now. Cost effective now in new construction. This stuff is going to continue sliding down the cost curve, and we're going to underprice oil and coal within 10 or 20 years if we let the free market loose on this problem.
One of the issues that's been driving yeah. the price of oil in recent years has been the instability in countries like Iraq and
yes.
in the Middle
right.
East. And
yes.
you have been critical of the U.S. intervention in Iraq recently, aimed at the group known now as the Islamic State. And you've been critical right. of calls to increase U.S. efforts in Syria against the Assad regime there. What is the U.S. role in that region as you see it?
We have a distinct humanitarian role. We have a role in trade. There are cases when coordinated economic, stiff economic sanctions should be used and have been used to good effect, like in Iran. We seek not to have Iran have a nuclear bomb, as is being used now against Russia in their breach of the treaty in the Ukraine with respect to Ukraine's abandoning its nuclear weapons stockpiles. So there is a role, again, for coordinated economic sanctions, for humanitarian aid in the case of the folks being brutalized, this genocide by ISIS. There's a role for trade, for diplomacy, and there's a role for engagement of the regional powers whose interest is just as strong as ours in regional stability. What has not worked is this crazy, haphazard United States policy. Less than a year ago, in September of 2013, Jean Shaheen voted to bomb al-Assad in Syria and for the purpose of strengthening ISIS. Now here we are bombing ISIS to weaken them. Less than a year later, we have this crazy, haphazard policy, no plan to win the war, no plan to exit. So we need to reinstate a long-term military strategy, and I don't think it requires boots on the ground for Americans. The notion that we need to defend territory in the Middle East with American boots on the ground or 10 or 20 years of bombing is going to work for us. There is a global war on terror. It originates now in 20 countries that we know of. We have a failure of on-the-ground intelligence that resulted in us less than a year ago seeking to strengthen ISIS, now to bomb them. So obviously we need the strongest U.S. national defense in the world. We need the most technologically advanced defense in the world. We're weak in certain areas, as I mentioned, on-the-ground intelligence, industrial espionage, cyber warfare. Our pants are down in these areas, so I perceive the need to strengthen in that area. But we do not need American soldiers, boots on the ground, coming home, these young men and women coming home in boxes without legs and with brain injuries. I am sickened to my heart, and it is not enhanced U.S. national security. So if there are cases when ISIS and other organizations are threatening American national security, contrary to the Obama-Shaheen approach, which is to bomb and hold territory, we can use surgical mechanisms to eliminate these specific threats when on the ground and other means of intelligence discloses such threats, wherever they may originate in the world.
So it's not necessarily that the U.S. wouldn't use airstrikes, it's that it needs to be done under certain circumstances?
Well, again, we were proposing, and Jean Shaheen voted to bomb al-Assad September 2013 to strengthen ISIS. Here we are bombing to weaken ISIS less than a year later. This is haphazard. There is no plan. There is no strategy to win. There is no strategy to exit. If we're going to conduct war to hold territory, there has to be an objective and a plan to win and exit. There is no such plan in this case. Tactically in this case, there's genocide going on. There's a humanitarian role for bombing during which we execute a humanitarian assistance for the Christian people who are being subject to the ISIS genocide at this point. Beyond that, there is no plan that I can discern from Shaheen or Obama.
On immigration, you've called for additional resources and personnel to secure the border, and that could be costly, according to a report from Bloomberg Government, that securing the border could cost an additional securing the border could cost about $28 billion a year. That's about what we pay now for the entire Department of Justice. That would be money well spent?
Well, we're spending, the latest numbers I've seen is that we're spending about $18 billion a year to secure the border, and obviously it's not very effective. We have the most porous border of any nation in the industrial world. This is insanity. No other industrial nation on the face of the earth has an open border like this. So if they can do it, we can do it. So we need to shift resources to building a 1,900-mile fence, and it's going to be a fence which will be physical and technological, and we have to enforce that fence. If we have an open border, we're encouraging two things. We're encouraging people to continue to flow across the border under the notion they can come to America and get free housing, food, education, which our towns and cities such as Manchester can't afford right now. And we're delaying, we're enabling these corrupt dictatorships in countries like in Central America to persist in subjugating their people to gang warfare and internal terrorism in their own countries. We're enabling these dictators to persist in their bad governance with this open border policy. So if we're going to be genuinely humanitarian, we need to, and again, here's where humanitarian aid is needed, build a fence, jobs for Americans and people who are legally entitled to be here, and help and force these dictators, these corrupt dictators and these gang infested countries in Central America and elsewhere to internally reform themselves. That's how we're going to help the people in Central America.
And then of those individuals who are already in the country, you've said no amnesty. What do you propose then for them?
The first step to build support among Americans for immigration reform, and we obviously have problems in our immigration law. We have to begin with securing the border, and that will take time. It can't be done in a month. It can't be done in a year. Once we secure the border and it's no longer porous, that might take a few years, it'd be my guess. You come back to the American people and say, are you ready now for immigration reform? We have immigration policies, again, that are unlike most other countries in the world. We need an immigration policy that is pro-America, pro-Americans. We want people to come to our country. Immigration is tremendously beneficial for our country. Legal immigration, tremendously beneficial for our culture and the civil society that we enjoy. You look at the variety of restaurants we have in our streets, in our towns and cities. That results from our embrace of different cultures coming to the country. But we need to bring people in who are self-sustaining, forgive me for saying this, who are disease-free, who are not going to be burdens on our welfare system, and who will bring us job growth. So let us shift immigration policies in a manner that enriches and enriches our country's culture and strengthens our economy.
I
think Americans will be ready for that debate once we secure the border, not a promise to secure the border, but actually securing the border. Then we'll deal with the other issues.
The last question I ask of candidates is to look 6 years down the road, assuming that you win the nomination and then go on to win the general election. What can the citizens of New Hampshire see 6 years from now that they may not see now that Senator Jim Rubins could point to and say, this is where I made a difference
in
the country?
I'd like to bring bold ideas to the table, as I did in the state Senate. I wrote and passed the charter school law. I initiated debate on electricity competition, which has saved millions of dollars for the people of the state. I wrote the state's victim restitution law, so that if you're a victim of crime, your economic costs will be paid back to you by the perpetrator, by the criminal. I got SB2 voting, all-day voting in the towns and school districts passed. So I can take on the tough issues and get them moved into law. It's going to take 60 votes to get solutions to our country's serious challenges through the U.S. Senate. It's going to take someone who is thoughtful. It's going to take someone who's principled, who can articulate those principles, and it's going to take a statesman to navigate our way through the fog of the differing viewpoints toward 60 votes in the U.S. Senate to get some solutions on the table, talked about among the American people, and passed into law. So you can go to my website, jimrubins.com. I've got more ideas than probably all the other candidates combined as to how we can start solving our nation's problems. And I'm asking the voters of this state, Now that there's a couple of the candidates that are fully resourced, that have fully resourced, fully staffed campaigns, the argument that the anointed one has all the money, that's no longer true now. Now the people of the state of New Hampshire are looking at the candidates. What kind of talent is being brought to bear? Is the candidate thoughtful? Does the candidate have a track record? Does the candidate live in the state and have roots here? And people are looking at those things, and they're finding me pretty attractive. JimRubins.com.
Jim Rubins is a candidate running for the Republican nomination in U.S. Senate. Thanks for talking with me.
All right.